Welcome to the Endless Spiral Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Russell, and this is a podcast dedicated to unraveling the intricate threads of mental health, eating disorders, and body positivity. We'll explore the profound depths of the human mind while shedding light on the often turbulent journey towards well-being. So join me as I chat to experts in their chosen fields, as well as individuals with lived experiences. We'll explore the multifaceted nature of mental health, while also dismantling stigmas along the way. In this episode, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by counsellor, psychotherapist and professional coach Orla Reid. Orla specialises in generalised counselling, sexual therapy, sexual recovery therapy, couples addiction therapy and fertility counselling. In this episode, which is going to be part one of two episodes, we are focusing on GAD, which is generalised anxiety disorder. This is something both myself and Orla have lived with for most of our lives. Orla gives some insight into her own life experiences, as well as explaining what anxiety looks like to different people, and she also offers up some advice on managing your anxiety on a daily basis. We will be recording part two of this conversation very soon, where we will be chatting about recovery, coping strategies, help and support, and of course, we want to delve into that topic of sexual therapy and what it can do for people's relationships. As always, please don't forget to like this podcast, leave a review where you can, and subscribe wherever you are listening from. And I hope you enjoy this episode. Well, Orla, thank you very much for giving up your time to chat to me on the podcast today. I know you're mentally busy and you've got loads going on. And obviously, as I mentioned in the intro there, you actually cover quite a broad spectrum of topics, which some of the stuff I didn't even realize you did. It's amazing. But obviously we're going to be chatting about, we'll focus our conversation on anxiety today, because we obviously chatted before on a generalized anxiety disorder, something we've both kind of lived with. So I think it'd be good to get a male and female perspective on that. But anyway, Orla, how are you?
I'm good. I'm delighted to be here. We've been talking for a long time.
Yeah, we have actually. Yeah. I think we were supposed to do this episode probably a year ago, I'd say.
Yeah, maybe longer. And I've been following you and your journey. I remember a couple of years ago hearing an interview with you on the radio, talking about body dysmorphia. And I sent you a message straight after, and it was great. We've been in touch ever since then. So
yeah,
I'm delighted to be here talking about anxiety, which is something that I don't get to talk about much myself. Yeah. And yet it is such a massive part of my life and the life of some of the clients that I work with. So we have a common experience of GAD. Yeah. So I'm delighted to talk about that and explore it today.
Yeah, we definitely do. So as I said, I obviously knew you did a few things because we've been chatting for a while, but then I went on your website and there's a few other things you do as well. Do you want to give people just a bit of an insight into yourself before we kind of get into our life experiences? Maybe we give people a little bit of an overview of just kind of what you do.
Yeah, no problem. I'm a psychotherapist and coach. I'm based here in Kildare. Since COVID, I work mostly online with my clients. My private practice started back when I was 22. I actually spent 5 or 6 years training to be a complementary health therapist. So massage, reflexology, Reiki. I was really into spirituality, all these types of holistic therapies. And I moved into them in an effort to learn how to manage anxiety. I was very interested in the physical body and physiology. So I spent a good few years working in that and did some traveling, and it led me into psychology. I would have been in my own therapy all that time and experienced the amazing benefits of that safe space in therapy. So I moved into psychotherapy and did a degree, and I've been qualified now for about 12 years as an accredited psychotherapist, working in a very broad area of psychotherapy, but I like to specialize. It makes work easier to specialize. And I'm fascinated with psychology and self-help. So the areas that I work a lot now in is psychosexual therapy and addiction recovery. Sometimes there's a crossover between those things. And in psychosexual therapy, it brings in everything from sexual disorders to fertility, performance anxiety, might be sexual trauma. So it's quite a, I mean, everything, we're sexual beings, you know, so it brings in relationships, parenting styles, all these types of things. So now I am in Kildare working online. I'm also a mother of two young children. And yeah, that's part of my story, you know. I'm always quick to jump into the professional piece, but I'm a mother first. So yeah, that's, I suppose the anxiety has been there the whole time, you know, in the background. And it's made me much better at my work and much more sensitive to people and people's needs, and it shows up every single day in the therapy room.
Can I just go back to something you said there about the sexual psychotherapy? I think we might have to come back and do an episode on that, because that's actually something that I have actually been talking about before that I wanted to do an episode on. And it's probably like there's a lot in that. So maybe we might come back and do another episode on that if you're all right about doing that. Because like I said, that's quite big as well. And then you've got, as you said, like the fertility stuff, but then you've got the performance stuff, you've got the relationship stuff, the anxiety stuff. So I think there's like, would you find that would kind of take up a lot of your sessions, or would it kind of just come into like someone else's conversation, as in a part of a conversation, or would you find you're kind of like, you know, concentrating on that with people?
I think because I specialize in sexology, when people come into the session, they're prepped for a conversation about something that's affecting them as a sexual person or in terms of sexuality. But that sometimes won't come up with a general therapist, because the therapist mightn't bring it up, and it's easy to always talk around that. So, I mean, it's such a broad subject. And people will often come in maybe to talk about pornography or performance anxiety, another type of anxiety. And in order to work through that, we have to look at the whole person. You know, everything is happening in their life and their previous experiences and how they're coping now. But it is so broad that you could spend hours talking about talking about it in some context or another.
Yeah, well, maybe we will actually, because it is, like I said, it is something that I would like to cover as well, and probably like I said, we'll just kind of give that its own space, and we'll actually just we'll dedicate an episode to just that. Actually, before we move off that, I just popped into my head. Would you find you'll have more male or female clients coming to you willing to talk about that?
A really good question. I noticed it kind of fluctuates. I'm going to say it's kind of 50-50.
Okay.
You know, it is very different types of problems. I would do a lot of work with men around erectile dysfunction, problem porn use, compulsive sexual behavior. So on one end of the spectrum, but then with women, they will be on a different end of the spectrum where they're wanting to improve libido, boost libido. There might be sexual trauma or post-pregnancy, or different types of conditions that affect sexual functioning. So I have to say probably 50-50.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting that you said that it's 50-50, but also it's for different aspects of it. I think that's quite interesting as well.
Yeah, very different. And contrary to what a lot of people think, I find that male clients are fantastic in therapy. You know, they're very practical, always really, really engaged. They're very invested in the process. They jump too quick to getting a fix, you know. And they're often not as connected with what's happening in the body. But then women will work through, I want to say, sex therapy slower and are maybe more in the emotional, and they're not as good as the practical. So again, I really see huge gender differences in how people show up in therapy and how they cope with that process. Anything to do with sexual issues or sexuality, it's a slow burner. And that can make it a little bit more difficult as a therapist, you know, because I know that the pace is slow, but the client wants the quicker fix. So we're always trying to get that message across. There's no antidote, there's no immediate one or two things that you can do to change something that's such an intrinsic part of yourself that takes time to developmentally change.
Okay, get it, got you. Right, let's park that for now because we probably will spend a few hours on that. Let's talk about you for a minute. So, we've obviously been chatting for ages, and you've kind of lived with anxiety for a long time. You even, I think you mentioned me saying you were born anxious, and I've heard other people. Look, I'm probably the same, to be honest. So let's chat about you because I think it'd be good to get a female and a male perspective on this as well. Lots of people live with anxiety, maybe some people more than others. I think there's a lot of maybe trends out there, especially for on social media, where people will maybe use the word anxiety quite a lot and maybe a little bit out of context, and kind of, to me anyway, in my opinion, it takes away from someone who really does live with anxiety. But obviously there's different kind of, you know, there's different kind of ranges in that as well. So let's chat about you. So you've been, or at least you've had anxiety since you were born, as you say.
My earliest memories are anxiety based. My earliest memories are kind of being very fearful, but with no imminent threat or no particular threat around. So when I think, you know, even up to the age of 10, I had high anxiety, very internalized. It wouldn't have been really obvious on the outside, but other personality traits, the very quiet child, the child that tiptoed through the world, apologized, wasn't heard, and was afraid to be heard. You know, I often describe my childhood as feeling invisible and wanting to be invisible in equal measure, you know. But at the same time, I was also an introvert, and I think you see people who are introverted in nature, this is my opinion, not a clinical fact, experience anxiety to maybe a different level that someone who's an extrovert experiences anxiety. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think, do you know what? I think someone who's an introvert, as you say, probably internalizes their anxiety a lot more. And they probably could be wrong again, and this as well. They might self-stigmatize quite a lot. I mean, as they're older, obviously, as you said, like a 10-year-old, like my, I have a daughter who's 10, and I do, she does suffer with anxiety quite a lot. Now she's really good actually being able to articulate to me when she's feeling anxious. She doesn't know the word anxious, but she's able to say to me that she feels tight, or she's able to kind of explain her feelings a bit more, which I think is amazing, because I know at 10 years old I wasn't able to do that. So I think maybe it depends, but yeah, I think probably maybe introverts probably internalize it a lot more. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. And I think of it, like I grew up in the 80s, so
Yeah, me too.
back in school then, the way children were taught was different. The loud child got the attention and was the problem maker. So the quiet child back then were pretty much, it's not that they were ignored, but they no attention was focused on them. Now I have to say, for me up to the age of 10, because my anxiety was ho so high, I had a lot of problems with food, and that's how I managed my anxiety. And I mean, I've spent 20 years, maybe 25 years in therapy now, so I have a good understanding of what was happening, you know, in retrospect. But for me, anxiety was very high. The best way that I could manage that was through food, because there's such a link between the concerns that you have and physiologically how you feel. So if you're anxious all the time, I don't know about you, but it's very exhausting. You feel physically sick. There's a constant flow of cortisol, adrenaline running through your body. It's exhausting. And because your body's tired, you actually have more anxiety. So you're kind of always in this cycle, or
You could
I
all
love
you
your
could
word,
almost say you're
spiral.
almost in an endless spiral.
Endless spiral, yeah. And that word spiraling is something that I use a lot. So for me, the best way for me to try to manage my anxiety by my undeveloped brain was through food. If I didn't eat, I wouldn't feel sick. And because I didn't feel sick, I thought it would help me manage anxiety. But again, I suppose a lot of anxious children, they might feel anxiety, but they associate it with different things. So for me, I associated it with food. So food made me very anxious as well. You know, I think when you grow up in anxiety, and I'm not sure if this is your experience, we internalize and develop lots of phobias. So I had lots of phobias
Yeah.
and lots of very irrational thoughts and thinking. I would have an irrational fear growing up of getting sick, of choking, of food, dying in my sleep, like all these things that a 10-year-old should not be worrying about.
Yeah, it's
And yet
funny you
that
say
was
that. Sorry, go on.
real. And yet that's the reality of that 7-year-old or 10-year-old child. You know, it's nonsensical. And yet it that's how I thought, you know.
Yeah, it's just your thoughts are so irrational, and even now as an adult, it's the same. But it's funny you say that just about like as a up on the kind of like a 7 to 10 year old. I mean, I never really felt any anxiety up until probably 10, 11, 12, and especially in my early teens. I don't ever remember feeling anxious as a child. And then, because I've got, like I said, I've got 3 small kids, and I grew up in the 80s as well. And I noticed in, like I said, one of them, my daughter, and I can clearly see that she's quite anxious about a lot of things. I don't ever remember being like that at her age. I think I was an introvert, but I was also quite happy child. I was probably quite friendly child. I didn't really have these irrational phobias that you talk about. Got them when I was older, but I didn't have them when I was younger, and I don't ever remember having the food thing until I was older. So for me, a lot of the stuff came later on when I started to become quite aware of my body and myself. Up until that point, I don't really remember having any issues with anxiety or food. I don't remember anyway, and I don't think I did, but you kind of you block a lot of this stuff out anyway, so that's not to say I didn't, but I don't think I did.
It's interesting you say that, because when I think of my clients and my own experience, because we're in an anxious state and we're worrying about something that has happened or might happen or catastrophizing, that was my forte. We're not really present. So you forget, because you weren't really present, you don't have a memory of what was happening at that time.
Good point. Yep.
You know, so I think that's quite normal. It's like if you're driving your car and you're rushing all the way to Cork, and you're trying to think about what you do, and you get there, you can't remember going through towns and villages because you were physically present, but cognitively you weren't present, you know. So I think that's quite common with that kind of anxious disposition, I call it, you know. So what happened for me anyway would have been I found my own ways to cope, and they worked and some didn't work. And like all children and adults, we do find ways to cope. I would have had a big problem with articulating what I wanted to say. So again, I just stopped trying to articulate that. And we were talking about attachment. So for me, it was only in my 30s when I really started delving into attachment styles. I connected my attachment style growing up with my anxiety growing up. So I would have had a very anxious attachment, lots of worrying about, let's say, my mother disappearing or dying or not being available. I was very attached to her. So, you know, like an anxious child sitting waiting for her to come home all the time. And the way that plays out is that you learn that you can't trust yourself to take care of yourself. You're always waiting on something outside of yourself to feel calm and soothed. And I suppose for adults, that plays out then in adulthood as well with romantic relationships. So my anxiety progressed and progressed. I can't say it got better because it didn't. It got progressively worse. But I think for what we forget about anxiety is because it has such a strong physiological impact on the body, it's also affected by so many factors, different triggers, how you're eating, what you're eating, your environment. You know, we're influenced in so many different ways. So for me, because I wasn't eating, I would have been more at a disposition, or sorry, more predisposed to have nutrient deficiency, which create more anxiety. So I suppose for anyone listening who might be experiencing anxiety, instead of blaming yourself, there are so many factors that could be feeding into why you have anxiety or why you might have had it in the past. And they are, you know, the things that you're listening to, the people you're around, the energy that they bring. We have climate anxiety now, health anxiety, which is absolutely huge. That was one of the ones that I would struggle with the most. So there are so many different things that can influence anxiety. And it's only when you look back, you start to put everything together and it makes sense. It doesn't make it go away now. And then I suppose I would have gone through secondary school again. Wouldn't have been great at school academically. And it's not that I didn't have the capacity to, but I was so distracted by that low level general anxiety that it was very difficult to function.
Yeah, you know? I'm exactly the same.
Yeah. So it can come across as similar to ADHD, you know, very similar traits. And again, you know, the world, you feel quite fearful as well. So it's possible that you're living in that kind of sense of fear, but you are always responding to that then. The world feels scary. Your experiences are scary. It feels unsafe and you get caught in this cycle of anxiety then. So that definitely didn't disappear. It was always there, progressed and got worse at periods in my life, and would have developed into panic attacks, anxiety attacks, which are very visceral and physiological, and that nearly reinforces the anxiety that you have. For me, it changed how I would, places that I would go to, different locations, different experiences. So we become quite avoidant. I'm not sure if that's your experience as well.
Yeah,
we'd have a tendency to avoid those areas, people, places that escalate, you know, what you're feeling.
Yeah. Obviously, this is an audio podcast, but like, I'll have a few clips up. But if for anyone listening, I'm literally just sitting here, just nodding the whole time as Orla's talking. I'm just in agreement with everything because it's like exactly the same. The avoidance, the anxious attachment, the catastrophizing, the school, the food. It's like just listening to my story. It's so similar, and I think that's so important as well. And that's why I thought, you know, this episode would be very good as well and beneficial to other people, because it kind of just shows you that, okay, we grew up around the same time, but men and women can have the same feelings. Okay, your life experiences could be different, but the feelings and the emotions and the triggers and whatever you have can be so similar that the whole thing about stigma, and I will talk about that as well, and it's just like, I think, especially for men, because look, I've come across this so often, and I did it as well. And you know, the avoidance stuff you're talking about. You're like, I avoided everything, and also because you feel so stigmatized that you do avoid. And I know you avoid it because you're anxious, but I also think you avoid the going places and avoiding people because you're ashamed as well. You know, you shouldn't be, but I think that's also another, that's a generational thing as well, where like even now kids will have social media to take into account with, you know, the stuff that you're talking about being anxious. We didn't have that when we were growing up, thank Christ.
Thank God. I think that so many times how difficult it is for young people these days to be grown up with such an interference in their life, and so many. I mean, look, it can be positive as well, but to be taken away over and over through the day from themselves in a way that I want to say it's a little bit corrosive. You know, I really feel for young people these days, particularly if you're highly sensitive. So I'm going to say I was definitely a highly sensitive child. I would have perceived experiences or maybe people's reactions in a way that I would think it was something personal that I did or that I wasn't good enough. It doesn't mean that that wasn't the reality 99% of the time. But for young people these days who are highly sensitive and are influenced in so many ways that they can't control, it must be desperately challenging. And again, I know that's their norm. And you know, young people will find their own way through that, but it doesn't make it any easier, particularly for some children, just don't find living as easy. And that's something that I always came back to, particularly in my own therapy, that I used to feel that I was less than, that I was, I used to feel like I was displaced growing up. It's like that I was missing something that made me feel that I was in the right place, and I just couldn't see, I just couldn't cope the same as everybody else. I felt very different because of that, and that affects your self-esteem, you know, in lots of different ways. Never feeling good enough, or not being able to cope, or like being amazed at people. I had a lot of very friends who had very strong personalities, and in a way, I was really drawn to those people, but I was mesmerized by their recklessness or not caring what teachers thought or not caring how they looked. It was seemed so far away from how my brain worked.
You've mentioned, I think, three times just there about not being good enough. Yesterday, I shared a blog that I wrote about feeling not good enough. I'm 43 years old, and I wrote that blog yesterday. You were talking about, when you're a child. It's just, for me, it's never gone away. I've been having quite a bad case of feeling not good enough recently, feeling, as you said, less than, I think you explained there. Can you talk about that for a minute? So for me anyway, it's never really gone away, and it comes out in different ways, but it all obviously goes back to my childhood when I obviously felt not good enough. I felt not very supported. I felt not very we weren't very affectionate. We were, like that type of stuff. And it's always just never gone away. And it's coming out again at the moment where I just feel not good enough. But it's coming out in, say, relationships and stuff where it probably shouldn't be. But you, do you still have that feeling now, or were you able to work on that for it to go away, or does it always kind of raise its head every now and again?
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? You know, you're 43 and 44, how things can play out and continue to play out, even if it's just at a very low level. You know, we have that word imposter syndrome, which I absolutely despise. But for me, I think it would still play. Yeah, for me, it's just tied into that anxious attachment or that sense of comparing yourself to other people, that low-level anxiety. Am I enough? Am I doing enough? Could I be doing more? And I suppose if I was to bring it back to you or me, what are we trying to measure ourselves against? And why even bother trying to measure yourself against 7 other billion people in the world, you know, and focusing on the things that you do good and the things that you enjoy and the things that make you feel fulfilled and purposeful instead of focusing on the things that you mightn't be good at. There are a billion things I'm not good at, but do they need to be relevant in my everyday life? No. I think though that when you're feeling low and you were saying you're not feeling great at the moment, when you're feeling low and when you're getting burnt out or I'm getting burnt out, my anxiety starts to go through the roof because again, coping strategies, not feeling good enough, the pressure, like so much to do. I think it's harder to, I think self-esteem fluctuates. That's my feeling, you know.
Yeah, completely agree.
So again, for me, it's definitely something that's present to some degree or another. But I think at one point in my life, for some reason, you know, we have a life experience, we talk about a breakdown and a breakthrough, and it changes how we, it's like a paradigm shift. I love that word, you know, it's like it changes you forever. And it can change how you think about things forever and how you function forever. So I've had a couple of breakdowns in my life, and they've turned into breakthroughs, and they're a part of me. And you know, I often talk about being in recovery, so I consider myself in a recovery process. When we talk about recovery, we talk about recovery from substances typically, or alcohol. For me, my recovery is from, you know, depression, clinical depression. And that's very much tied into anxiety. And during those times, I felt like nothing, you know, that you don't deserve anything. You can't speak for yourself. You stop caring because it's so exhausting to care. So I think that sense of self fluctuates depending on how you're doing, what's happening in your life, the types of stresses there are. I balance that out by learning. I love learning and I love academia. That makes me feel strong in myself and in my thoughts and feelings. And that's where I get my sense of value. And I suppose I get it in other ways as well, you know, whether that's being outside or doing things that I really deeply enjoy. So I can identify what you're saying there, you know. I see you. When you're sensitive, we're just always noticing these little fluctuations. What do you think?
Well, it was interesting just writing the blog because I find writing c quite cathartic as well, and it's something I didn't do before. And obviously in the last few years I've started doing that. And I wrote yesterday that like I want to be good enough for me before I can be feel like I'm good enough for someone else. It's so similar to just like the self-love thing. I have to be able to love yourself before you can embrace someone else's love. And I thought I was, I mean, I've done that, and well, not done that, but you know what I mean. I feel much better about that now. But the whole not feeling good enough, I thought I was doing much better, but it's just raised its head again lately. And I think it's just, as you said, I've been just feeling overwhelmed with stuff, and I was doing so well, but like I suppose you have these ups and downs. And as I wrote, I think probably in one of the blogs, like I don't mind having a bit of a blip. I don't mind going sideways as long as my next step is forward. I don't mind doing that. And I do think it's quite important as well to be kind of self-aware of these things as well, which I'd like to think I am. And you're obviously very self-aware as well. But I do struggle as well, and I am struggling at the moment with, as you said, about exhausting. It is exhausting. It's physically exhausting. It's mentally exhausting. Use that term, your anxiety goes through the roof. I use that term all the time because that's exactly how I just that's how I phrase it. And my anxiety has gone through the roof so many times in the last few months. And it seems to like it's like you open up the floodgates. And it just comes at you like, like a fucking tornado or whatever you want to call it. It just comes at you. And I embrace the bad days and I try not let them continue. But the whole self-doubt and worth and not feeling good enough is a hard one for me. It's a tough one at the moment and I'm struggling to get my head around it. I don't know whether it's coming from other stuff. Is it romantic relationships? Is it childhood, which is probably where it's come from? You know what I mean? I'm finding it hard to just understand it all at the moment, and then that kind of makes it a little bit more overwhelming as well. So it's a bit of a difficult one for me at the moment.
Yeah, well, you mentioned romantic relationships there. So, if you think of attachment and there are each there are four attachment styles. So the one that I would have grown up with and continue to manage in equal measure is that anxious attachment style. So I think that self-doubt, questioning, chronic worrying. We're always looking for validation that we are enough, that things are safe, that you're equal, and that this person needs you in their life. So I think that comes with that insecure attachment style or anxious attachment style. And sometimes getting into a relationship that's quite new can aggravate. That idea of kind of pushing in on a soft spot. So it might be something that we notice until we're back in a relationship or something happens in a relationship where it raises its ugly head and all those types of characteristics start to come out, second guessing, chronic worrying, am I enough? Did I do something wrong? All of these anxious type thoughts.
The
So
overthinking starts and you overthink everything.
overthinking everything. Yeah, absolutely. But back to this idea, it's of being good or bad. Am I good enough? I suppose I always think of what's that, that's too simplistic, and it's also a criticism and a judgment. We're judging our perception of what is good and what is bad. How about completely restructuring that thought and pulling away from something being good or bad and just is? I think that works, certainly works for me. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I suppose it's just a self-acceptance, isn't it? Now, I mean, and I say self-acceptance, I don't mean, well, if you have things you want to work on, you just accept that that's who you are. I don't mean that because we can always be better, we can always improve. Nobody's perfect, and I'm certainly one when I have made a mistake, or if I have things that I feel I can do better, I will certainly not accept that. Do you know what I mean? So that's the little difference I will see there. But also feeling, if you feel you've given your best, that can be enough. You know what I mean? So that's the kind of difference for me, is I can put, if I feel I've given it my all, I'm okay with that, and that can be enough. It's when things can happen, or when this and the negative thoughts start going on in your head, and you're starting to realize these are just kind of irrational thoughts. And you can do better. That's when I won't accept that, especially when I know I can work on this and I can be better, and I can be better for me, and I can be better for people around me, and it'll improve my life, it'll improve my mental health. So does that make sense? You know what I mean? So I will accept it to a point, but then I won't accept when I feel that I can actually do better.
Yeah, you're describing there that kind of positive reinforcement, positive self-talk, constructive self-criticism, nearly reparenting. But I suppose I also think of that, Keith, in the way of we're kind of in this culture that since social media, I think, of always trying to strive for more. Better, the best, the newest, the most innovative. I don't really agree with this idea of, doing your best all of the time. That's not realistic. I mean, it makes sense when it comes to something performance, but to always strive to be doing your best all of the time, I just don't think it's realistic or that it should work. I don't think we should, that's what we should be striving. Of course, it makes sense if you're doing triathlons or you're competing or you want an amazing score in a GH, in your exams. But outside of that, do we need to be striving for that? Are there other things to be channeling your energy into, like joy, happiness?
Yeah, good point.
connection.
I suppose it just
That's
adds extra pressure onto yourself. That's probably not needed as well, isn't it? So yeah, no, I take your point. Yeah, that makes sense.
yeah.
But you also mentioned a second ago, because it's just been in my head a little bit, because I've had them as well. So you mentioned the kind of anxiety attacks, and then people say panic attacks. What's the difference in them? Is there a difference, or are they just what people call them?
Yeah, I was thinking about this last night actually. I scopped, so I definitely think there's a difference. For me, a
Okay.
panic attack is something that comes on really quickly, very visceral response. You have that fight or flight mode, you're ready to bolt, you nearly feel physically ill. There's a very quick response reaction, and it feels quite traumatic.
Okay.
Whereas an anxiety attack for me is something that is longer, that mightn't feel as extreme or as intense. I would have more anxiety attacks. A panic attack might happen for me. Let's say it's happened to me in on a bus or in an airport or in a supermarket or at a gig maybe. But an anxiety attack, it's a for me anyway, it's a lower level experience. It's not as scary, but it feels overwhelming and it can
Okay.
go on for a longer period of time. And sometimes it's building and then will kind of
Yes.
come
Yep.
down. So for me, they are very different. I changed my language around that a long time ago because for me, that word attack, it's quite a threatening word. So for me, when I think about anxiety, I feel it's like an energetic feeling. You know, I've often described it as when my anxiety is really high and persistent, it's like a leaking or a seeping feeling. I feel like I can't control what's happening in my body. It's an awful feeling, you know.
Yeah.
So I changed it to, it's like a panic surge or a panic and an anxiety surge. For me,
Okay.
that feels much more safe and comfortable. It helps me feel like I'm in more control of what's happening. Whereas an attack, you think of someone attacking you on the street and you're not prepped. Most of the time, if I was to have a panic attack, which I don't have as much anymore, I would definitely have anxiety attacks.
Yeah, me
It's
too.
something that I know is coming on and that I can kind of preempt in a way. So to me, they are different, and to be able to distinguish between those things can help how you cope and respond to that when it does happen. For me, panic attacks are very ritualistic. They'll happen in the same types of places. I know when they might happen. An anxiety attack can be something that nearly sneaks up on you, you know, when you're not quite expecting it.
Yeah.
Are they different for you, Keith?
Yeah, very different. Very different. Panic attacks, I don't think I get. I don't think I've ever had a panic attack, but I've definitely had anxiety attacks. I've had quite a few of them. And I think that's why I asked, because that's you explained it exactly. It's the slow build up. So, because usually I think when you have anxiety, you're kind of catastrophizing everything anyway, so you're well aware that you're already anxious. And I do think it's a feeling of, for me anyway, of being very overwhelmed and feeling that you can't cope. And yeah, it is a gradual build up. So yeah, I completely agree with that. Panic attacks, I don't usually have them because I'm already anxious long in advance before anyway, so it's not like a sudden burst of adrenaline. Well, you get that, I suppose, but no, I don't really get them. But the anxiety attacks, what do we call it? An anxiety surge, has definitely happened to me quite a few times. And for me, with the anxiety, and I don't know if anyone listening gets these as well, but I think I've heard a few people saying this, so I'm sure it's quite common. But I get headaches, I get tension headaches, which I know is quite common. But we were talking earlier on that you were listening to my podcast with Carla Foran, and she was talking about, she'd hold her anxiety in her tummy. And I think I mentioned on the episode with her is that I hold my tension in my back. So, and it's funny we're just mentioning this now, because what day are we today? So a couple of days ago, because I hadn't had a bad of a bit of a bad week last week, and I woke up Sunday morning, couldn't move my neck. I hold my tension in my shoulders and my neck. And I woke up and I could barely move my neck, and I can barely move it right now. A little bit better at the moment. So what happens to me is like, you're anxious and I get really tight. And this is what I was saying to you this morning or earlier on that my daughter said to me about she feels real tight. I presume she feels really tense and, your whole body just feels taut. And then what happens to me then, there's a bit of a release and then my neck goes into spasm or my shoulder blades go into a bit of a spasm. And I don't know if that's if you come across that one, but it's probably very common. Do you know what I mean? I'm sure it is.
It is. And you know, Keith, I mean, when you think of all the systems in the body, physiology, the brain, we have like the intellectual brain, the heart brain, the gut brain, what you eat, how stressed you are when you're eating, the digestive system, the immune system, everything is so interlinked, isn't it? So I think when you look at the symptoms of generalized anxiety disorder, one of the really prevalent ones there is physical pain, muscular tension. And that kind of brings me back to this idea that I come across all the time. People blame themselves for being anxious. Like sometimes and often, especially if you have, generalized anxiety disorder, it's just not something that nobody would choose to live like this. Nobody would choose to function in a world with anxious thoughts, always wondering what might happen or, trying to preempt what might happen. It's not a cognitive choice, but our body responds to some of these fears and catastrophes as if it's happening in the present. So, to think of if you get anxious or and you're feeling anxious all the time, body's in that fight or flight mode, we're not breathing, the diaphragm isn't moving a huge amount, that starts to restrict the stomach and the pelvic floor, the body is tensing up. And that could be happening. I mean, it is happening all through the day. So there are lots of physiological responses that happen as a result of perceived stress and anxiety. So it's logical that you would be experiencing lots of physical symptoms. Even, when I think of clients that I work with who might have sexual disorders or who are going through a lot of stress and anxiety, they'll often come into the room and it shows in their body language and how they move and in their movement. And it's everything is interlinked. It really, really is. And I think one of the best ways to manage anxiety is to allow yourself to come down into the body. So if you are that overthinker and you get those mental headaches and just, kind of exhaustive fatigue, that just can't think straight, overwhelm, those very strong sensory feelings, come down into the body, nearly surrender yourself and let yourself drop, be in the body and give your brain a release and space. So the more physical things, the more things that you're doing outdoors, it allows the brain to slow down and gives it a break, gives it a rest, so that actually the body can begin to rest and relax as well.
When you say come down into the body, so what do you mean by that?
When you think of the brain as one organ in the body, and yet if we're functioning 100% of the time there, it's going to get tired. So for me, I'm going to say 75. It sounds like a lot, different types of ways to manage anxiety. A large part of them are physical activities or things where I'm resting, relaxing, recuperating, restoring what's happening in the body. So there are things like just going out for a walk or maybe having a long sleep or having a power nap. Might be just lying down on the floor or lying with my feet up against the wall. So you're allowing yourself to be present in the body, notice what's happening in the body, listening to the breath work, listening to or feeling how the body is breathing. For me, things that work really well are yoga, Pilates. Mindfulness is an amazing thing because it's teaching you to hone in on all of the senses, sight, sound, smell, touch. So you're learning and you're allowing yourself to operate in the body, not in that cognitive mental space all of the time. It takes a while to get the hang of.
Yeah, because it is quite exhausting when you're in your own head all the time. And then that's when the headache, for me, and that's when the headaches start as well. The mindfulness is an interesting one because I know that can mean different things to different people. Just being mindful. What does being mindful mean to you?
For me, it is very much part of my daily practice. I was talking about recovery earlier. You know, I wake up every single day and I think, what am I doing today to mind myself? So for me, even that's a mindfulness practice. I think being in the present and functioning on what I have control of today is mindfulness, you know, and letting go of what's going on for other people, that's mindfulness. Tuning into what's happening in my body or how I mind it or what I'm putting into it. Going out into the environment, I love walks in nature and sea swims. To me, that's how I practice mindfulness. So it's a huge part of how I operate. It's hard when life is busy and you've got children, but it's a lovely practice and strategy to get used to. That helps, I want to say, regulate anxiety or certainly bring it down. But I mean, listen, mindfulness is different things to different people, isn't it? You know, it might be, I have a weighted blanket, I'll have a sleep for 15 minutes in the afternoon with that. It might be incense, might be burning some aromatherapy oil. Really small, simplistic, simple daily rituals. That's what mindfulness is for me.
Talk to me about this sea swimming. I've been trying to be People are trying to convince me to do it, and I wouldn't mind. I'm quite a good swimmer. I've swam before I could walk. It's the cold sea. Just I can't cope with it. What's the science around this? Convince me to do this.
Well, we'll have to go for a sea swim, Keith, because I know you're in Dublin and I'm not too far from you there. So we'll have to go and do it. And you know what? I think cold swimming is very popular, but from a trauma perspective, sea swimming, cold swimming, even if you're experiencing highly stressful thoughts and thinking, to submerge your face in really cold water for a couple of seconds, it makes the brain function in a different way. So cold water, all of those cold plunges, sea swims are amazing for PTSD and post-traumatic stress symptoms. For me, it is very cleansing and it's a shock to the system, but it
Tell me
helps
about
to
it.
ground you in a way that, you know, it can be difficult to get grounded like that when you have kids running around and clients and work, but there's something deeply healing and nurturing about that. Let's try it in the summer, Keith.
Oh, in the summer. Oh, I'm all for it in the summer. It's just not the winter. I took a dip probably a month or so ago. It must have been 10 seconds. And talk about PTSD. I'm still having that since that 10 seconds off the water. That was cold. I mean, that was ridiculously cold. It was dangerously cold, I think. Oh yeah, like during the summer, I'm all for it.
Yeah, it's very cold. I had a swim there at the weekend in Westport, and the sun was blazing, but it was incredibly, incredibly cold. But worth it, worth it.
And how long do you stay in for? Is it a dip or is it a swim?
It's a dip. Yeah, at this time of year, it's definitely a dip. But you know what? We talk about anxiety and control and how you manage it. There's something really liberating when you live with anxiety, but you do things that make you feel like you're in control. So for me, those types of things like the sea swims, making decisions around things, going out, getting stuff done, getting in for having a sea swim, like they all restore a sense of control. And you know, because of that helps to bring anxiety down. So, you know, it's, you know, if you're listening to this and you have your own anxiety, I think the biggest and best piece of work you can do is around that self-awareness and getting to know how and what you need to better manage and reduce what you're going through, you know, whether that's in your thoughts or in your feelings, and then separately look at what are all those external factors that you can start to manage maybe a little bit better. Because there are so many things that we know don't work for generalized anxiety disorder. Yeah, so that's where were we? We were talking about mindfulness.
We were, but I'm glad you mentioned the control thing, because for me that's massive. For me, it's the control thing, that when you feel like you have a lack of control, that's when my anxiety will go through the roof. And I think, for me anyway, and I think this is probably quite common, people with anxiety or generalized anxiety sort of, they procrastinate quite a lot. I certainly did, and certainly still do now. Also planning, and the reason why I mentioned this, because I've had this conversation before, and for me sometimes planning makes me anxious, but I know for other people planning actually helps with their anxiety. So it can be quite different for different people, obviously, you know.
Yeah, I would be the same as you there, Keith. I find that when I'm not in a great space, planning is just one more thing that I'm trying to manage.
Yeah.
And actually, just around anxiety, so we're in May, we're in April now. I'm noticing my anxiety is starting to come down because we've just come out of winter season, so I can't plan or organize anything with. I would also experience seasonal affective disorder, so anxiety is something that's very prevalent with that. And you know, if you're trying to learn how to manage anxiety, start to notice how the weather and your environment influences you. So I can't plan or organize anything, and I'm not great at getting stuff done in the winter. But if you like, now I'm getting much better organized. Coming to June, July, I will be high as a kite. My energy will be so high. I will be planning things that I'll definitely be regretting in the winter time. So getting to know yourself and, you know, different things influence why you're procrastinating. It's very stressful living with anxiety, you know, so normal things that other people don't bash an eyelid at feel completely overwhelming. One of the things that I struggle with the most at the moment is communication, like staying in contact with people, WhatsApp
Same.
messages, groups. I
Same.
just, some days I'm good at it, and other days I just want the world to go away, you know.
Yeah, and that's massive. Sorry, you interrupt me, because I just want to throw a point in there, because I'm glad that's another thing that I'm glad you've brought up, is the communication thing. And when you're feeling anxious, the lack of communication you have then to other people is can be quite, not be upsetting is the wrong word, but kind of confusing for other people, because they kind of like, you have these highs and lows. So they're like, well, you know, you were all chatty before, and now you go very quiet. And I think that's very important that you've mentioned that as well, because I don't want to, I don't, and I think is, I don't want to use anxiety for a cop out for everything, because that's dangerous as well. But the communication thing is very important, because I define myself when I'm feeling very anxious, which I am at the moment. Communicating is very difficult. I don't have the headspace. I don't have the energy. I'm not able to articulate things. I just can't. It's just such a struggle. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
And you know what, we talk about anxiety here, Keith. So what I mean, that's also stress related, isn't it? You know, when we're stressed and we're in our, well, I talk about comfort zone, stretch zone, and stress zone. You know, we're really just trying to get through the day and get the stuff that we need to get done. So is that stress? And again, to bring back in this idea of introvertedness, there's only, certainly for me, you know, I have a social battery, and you know, sometimes it's high, sometimes it's low. So you know, in a way, technology is so invasive and intrusive on, you know, trying to be human and have family and get through the school runs and all these different things that we have to do. So it's trying to balance that out, what you need to do and what has to be done, you know, really
Yeah.
I wish there was no such thing as smartphones. I feel like life
Yeah.
would be so much easier if we didn't have smartphones and that constant intrusion. And it's the pull, isn't it? It's the people always pulling for your attention, and
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah,
it's
it's
like you're walking around with
exhausting.
this little trigger in your pocket that, all you have to do is open it and you could be triggered by something. And this is what you're talking about earlier on about kids, they're carrying a phone around their pocket all the time. I mean, and it just shows you, as in you were just talking there, like about the smartphones and the communication. One thing that triggers me, and this is probably a bit irrational, but I know some people have said it, but is, and this is how, when you're feeling or when you're living with anxiety or when you're living with generalized anxiety, sort of how small these things can be to other people, but they're not to you. And here, I'll give you one example, is when I send a message to someone and they read it and it's left on read, but they don't respond. And this is where the anxious, probably attachment style comes in. And maybe it could be hours later or later on and they'll respond to it. I get really anxious and I get a bit upset about that. I take that quite personal. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, it only takes a couple of seconds to acknowledge the message. And to other people, they wouldn't even bat an eyelid about that. They're like, oh, I'm busy. I'll just reply to you later on. And that's the difference when most people who maybe have kind of get anxious every now and again, and people with generalized anxiety who live with anxiety all the time. There's some things that, and again, I don't want to use this as an excuse for everything, but I'm just giving an example that some things
Yeah.
are important to some and not to others, and you might not even realize you're doing it, but they do trigger you.
Yeah, really simple things. Again, we're very, we've talked about anxiety, generalized anxiety, introvertedness, the highly sensitive person. So that's a good example of where technology is kind of getting in the way of what. It's kind of interfering, isn't it? Or maybe triggering some of these things that you might be experiencing in some way or another. I think, though, we can give attention to things that escalate our anxiety as well.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I was going to mention that as well afterwards. That's exactly what it is. I can't even really phrase that any better. You're giving attention to things that aren't really that relevant and aren't really that important. And exactly, you're adding to your anxiety and you're adding to your triggers that really don't need to be there. But it's just one of them other things where you just kind of have to kind of navigate and try and just manage it the best you can and try and find solutions and try and understand it a little bit better, and hopefully you kind of get better at it. But yeah, I completely agree with that. You're putting obstacles in your way that probably don't need to be there.
Yeah. I suppose you were talking about that procrastination earlier, Keith, and planning and making plans. I think that comes with those anxious tendencies. Which takes a lot of time up in your mind, thinking about the past, the present, the future, what could happen, what might happen. I also love lists. They work really well for me. There's something, again, that when you're sitting down writing something out, it takes you out of your brain in a way. So, sometimes the things that we hate can also be good for us. It's like procrastinating over going for a walk or a swim. And then when you do it, the benefit so far exceeds the negative. That's like, I suppose, look, we're talking about mental health here as well, and that is one of the great challenges of mental health, is that we need our brain to make healthy decisions, but sometimes we're so tired and exhausted and mentally fatigued that simple things like walking to the shop to get milk just feel so monumental. So it's a very it is that cycle. It's a spiral. So I understand where you're coming from with that. Anyone with generalized anxiety disorder will understand that. And like you say, if you've never lived with it and you don't get it, you'll never grasp what that
No.
experience is like, and that's okay,
That's it. Look, you can only try and explain to people, and you can only do your best. Well, I think what I do now is I'll try and you mentioned this earlier on, actually, about kind of simple tasks. And what I try and do is I kind of try and break the day up into small, manageable, achievable tasks. And I mean when I'm feeling overwhelmed and anxious. So even like even just getting up and getting dressed, a little tick box. And I do the list you mentioned, I don't physically write it out, but I might have it in my head. I do
Yeah.
quite do lists because it does take me out of my head, and then it helps me kind of visualize things, if you know what I mean. And I know lists aren't for everyone, but it kind of helped me sometimes. But yeah, I'll break the day up into manageable tasks, and even like literally just putting the kettle on, or actually having something to eat in the morning, having something healthy to eat in the morning, some porridge or whatever. And it's just a little tick box that you can say, I'm going in the right direction. I'm getting through this, rather than before, maybe you would just, you'd nearly just take to the bed and you go, you nearly just kind of accept it, which is okay. As I said earlier on, I will accept it, as in I'll embrace a bad day. I won't embrace a bad week. I'll embrace a bad day.
I think for me, when I'm, keeping a tentative eye on the anxiety, it's really when the daily things start to slip that that's the sign. One of the things that I've learned, I mean, the more you learn about your anxiety and the more you work through that self-development piece and that self-help piece, the more you notice your little signs and triggers. And I have small little things where if I things that are really meaningful for me, if I stop doing them, I know, I need to keep an eye on myself. And I think if you've ever lived through depression or you've experienced depression, there's a terrible fear that comes back with being back in that place. So for me, if I don't keep track of it and I'm not keeping an eye on it and I'm not minding it, it could potentially happen again.
Yeah, me too.
But for me, small little things like if I stop recycling, or like I will always, it's like just wanting, I'll wash a can or, and then I'll let it dry and then I'll recycle it. But if I just go, I don't care to then throw it in the bin, that for me is a sign that I'm under stress or pressure. And that seems so trivial. But to me, recycling and, growing plants and all these things, they're so important to me. So it's really good to know what are those small little things that are a sign that, mind yourself,
Because it's
just.
part of you, and it's like when you stop doing them, you're giving up a part of you to your anxiety, and it does feel like a
Yes.
lack of control, doesn't it? Like you're giving up control of your anxiety, and you're giving up a part of you. I'm exactly the same. I can't even think of that off the top of my head now, but I would be like that too, where like you notice little small things that you would normally not bat an eyelid at doing, and all of a sudden, yeah, I completely get that 100%. I think we've probably covered loads. I think we literally could sit here for another 2 or 3 hours and talk about this. We really could. We'll
I
definitely come
agree.
back. Yeah, me too. We'll definitely come back and do another episode with the sexual stuff and the relationship stuff a bit more, because I think that's fascinating. That's definitely something I want to learn more
Yeah, I'd
about.
love to.
Yeah, there. Have you anything else you want to mention before we go?
You know what? I very quickly just to say that even though you have generalized anxiety disorder, you live with anxiety, the world goes on and we still get everything done. And it's something that's it's so invisible, isn't it? Other people can't see, that you might be having a panic attack or an anxiety attack. And so I suppose you talked, I think the first time I ever heard the term masking was something that you were talking about
Yeah, I wrote a
in.
blog called Taking Off the Mask or something like that, yeah.
That's right. That was the first time I heard that term, and that just blew my mind. So I guess if, even though we're talking about anxiety today, just to know that you can be highly functioning, fully functioning, you can be flourishing and also still live with generalized anxiety disorder. Just because somebody looks like they have it all together, or in my case, I'm a therapist, I'm always open about living with anxiety. That's a part of my makeup, and always will be. It doesn't change how I function in the world. It makes me better at some of the things I do. It makes me difficult to live with sometimes.
I'm the same, trust me. Oh, trust me, I'm exactly the same. I must do people's head ins at the time.
Yeah, that's it. Is it can be hard to live with as a partner as well. That's their problem, not mine.
as Ricky Gervais as always say, it's like being stupid. It's only a problem for other people.
But again, just for listeners listening, you know, I really want to get across the message, and I'm writing about this in a book at the moment, that stop trying to fix anxiety, stop trying to eradicate it, stop trying to fight it, stop trying to change and find a solution. It's such better energy spent learning to embrace it and build it into your makeup and find other positive ways that you can manage it and use it. I think that's something I would love to get that message across. It's a way to be more self-accepting, less critical, takes pressure off, flowing with the stream, not up against it all the time. So I think that's just something that I would have, you know, want to put out there as another strategy and another way of changing how you think about GAD. And that's not to say, well, I'm just going to give into it. That's not the same as embracing it.
Yeah, that's exactly, couldn't agree more. That's exactly what it is. And actually, just mentioning the mask thing, we were talking, I don't know if we were talking when we were recording, but we were mentioning at the beginning that you heard me talking to Caroline, and we were both talking about when people ask us how we are, we will tell them pretty much. And I think that goes back to just not wanting to wear a mask anymore. Because again, I'm afraid of slipping back into that as well, where you start putting the mask back on, you start hiding away, you start covering things up, and I just can't do it anymore. So the mask thing is quite important for me, is to not wear a mask anymore, because it's not going to do. And I mean this for everyone, it's not just for me, it's just my perspective on it, but this will be relevant to so many other people. It's just take the mask off, and once you take the mask off, you will be surprised at how much support and you will have, and how less lonely you will feel once you take the mask off, because people will see your authentic, genuine self, and you will see it as well. And you can embrace it, and they will embrace it. But people won't know how you are. People won't know what's going on if you have a mask on all the time, because it's just not going to help you. That's just my take on it anyway.
Well, I can't think of a better way to end this than on that note.
Yeah. Whose podcast is this? Who's you ending this or me? What are you joking? Before we go, do you want to let people know where they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, my website is orlareed.ie. I'm also on Instagram as the Wellbeing Psychotherapist, and on YouTube as the Wellbeing Psychotherapist. Or you can email me info@orlareed.ie. And I have a very clever booking system on my website, so you don't even need to talk to me if you want to talk to me. You can just go ahead and book your next appointment there for a morning and evening, and you can see appointments for the next 4 or 6 weeks.
Amazing. Brilliant. I've actually really enjoyed this episode. It's so educational, but so kind of liberating, and as well to just be able to have a conversation with someone who has such similar mindset to myself, but has gone through similar things. I mean, like I said, I sat there for most of the podcast just nodding away. I was agreeing with everything you said. So hopefully people will get some benefit from that. And also want to say thank you, Orla, for coming on. I know we've been planning this for quite a while, but I think it was worth the wait. I hope it was anyway, because I really enjoyed that. So thank you so much for giving up some time to chat to me today.
You're welcome.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thanks for coming on. Right, guys, we're going to leave that there. And I'll be back very soon with another episode of the Endless Spiral Podcast. Thanks again.